Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Arno de Borgrave, director of the Transnational Threats Project at CSIS, and I appreciate your turning out in such large numbers, and we're going to try to run this thing as close to schedule as possible. It is, as you know, a very important but often neglected subject we're discussing, the missing dimension of intelligence, open sources information. You should all have a copy of the CSIS report on your chairs. There'll also be audio transcripts of today's roundtable at the CSIS website. Now I'd like to introduce a very old friend, not so much in years, but in time, 26 years, someone really who needs absolutely no introduction, but I'll still mention that he is one of our heroes in America, the only man who's ever been director of Central Intelligence and director of the FBI in our history. And his service to the country goes all the way back to World War II in the Navy and the Korean War in the Navy. He is also, before his intelligence career started, where he spent 13 years at the very heart of intelligence and counterintelligence, he was a federal judge, and he is now with a senior partner with Milbank, Tweed, Hadley & McCloy, and chairman of the CSIS Transnational Threats Project, which I have the honor of directing. Judge, it's all yours.
Thank you, Honor, and good morning to all of you. I'm pleased to see such a nice turnout for this occasion. It's my privilege to be able to welcome you, and I will say very few words because there's a lot to be discussed this morning, and I know you will find it interesting and challenging. I hope we can avoid getting into cliches like filling in the dots. But in a very real sense, we have been looking hard in connection with the Transnational Threats Project, which I have the privilege of chairing, to see what areas need addressing and more serious focus. Arno has given a new acronym to the lexicon, although I'm not so sure it's new. Open source information translates into OSI, which to me translates into Office of Strategic Intelligence, which is anything but open. So if we can keep from confusing those two great objectives, I think we will understand more about the challenge of gathering enormous amounts of information, not only gathering it, but mining it appropriately. Those of us who look back, particularly as with John, who was senior advisor to the FBI following a great career at CIA, we recognize that there were the ability to mine is as important as the ability to collect, to know and to make it that information available and meaningful. Some of that information is public, and all organizations have had efforts to collect public source information, but we've never really confronted how valuable it could be when we are operating in areas of the world where we have not really developed on the classified side a level of intelligence that we would like. I don't want to encroach further on the work of Arno and Tom Sanderson, who produced this very useful publication and report to you this morning, and from what you're going to hear later on. We have to continue to have a need-to-know basis for certain kinds of intelligence in order to protect sources and methods. We also must need to know information that is not necessarily classified but would be extremely useful to us. We failed, I believe, in our public diplomacy efforts before 9/11. I hope that we will not fail in this endeavor. Arno, back to you.
Thank you so much, Bill. Before we get started, I would like to thank the Smith-Richardson Foundation and the Norwegian government and the Norwegian embassy here in Washington who have done so much to make this project possible. My first lesson in the importance of open source intelligence collection came from Jack Kennedy, President Kennedy, shortly before the assassination, when he said that he got more out of newspapers and magazines on Vietnam than he got out of his daily intelligence reports. I also should have been alerted much earlier in my career, back when I was the Newsweek Paris bureau chief in the early 50s, when the deputy U.S. labor attaché, which was then the legal cover for the deputy CIA station chief, told me that 95% of what he read I should already know from open sources or would know within a few days. During the Cold War, there was hardly anything we didn't know about the adversary, but what could be stolen by a double agent from a safe in the Soviet Defense Ministry does not exist, as you know, in the Al-Qaeda movement. The threat environment is entirely different. It's now one that requires a major effort and focus on open source collection. What is needed for effective open source collection is non-governmental expertise across many borders, not to supply actionable intelligence that identifies a specific terrorist or his or her location, but to share information and knowledge about the terrorist and his or her environment. The latest international bestseller by Oriana Fallaci, titled The Force of Reason, which followed her 2002 bestseller titled The Rage and the Pride, left absolutely no room for middle ground. The Fallaci Code is now shorthand for a Muslim conspiracy to conquer Europe. Fallaci, as you know, despises the Muslim intellectuals she sees on television talk shows that she says are in deep denial about being in the midst of a cultural, political, and existential war with Islam, of which terrorism is the flashiest but ultimately least important component. Famous for her interviews with the late Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran, Fallaci recalls that Algeria's late President Boumendienne said in 1974 before the UN General Assembly, and I quote, "One day millions of men will leave the southern hemisphere of this planet to burst into the northern one, but not as friends, because they will burst in to conquer, and they will conquer by populating it with their children. Victory will come to us from the wombs of our women," unquote. Similar clues are found even in books sympathetic to the plight of Muslim immigrants in the West, such as British journalist Adam Labour's book, A Heart Turned East, which quoted a London-based mullah as saying in 1997, "We cannot conquer these people with tanks and troops, so we have got to overcome them by force of numbers." Actually, such remarks, as you know, are commonplace. They are the texture, the tapestry, the code through which we understand with greater clarity the vast support movement enjoyed by Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. The geopolitical conquest by Eurabia is, of course, far-fetched, one I certainly don't subscribe to, but not to those whose perspective is perhaps Horizon 2040. When I first started covering the Middle East in 1952, there were 87 million Arabs. Today, there are 310 million. And in 2020, there will be 500 million. But then there are also the dispassionate observers, such as Danish author Gitte Clausen, who interviewed some 33 European Muslim community leaders and found none of the "we will bury you" bragging heard among rank-and-file admirers of Osama bin Laden. The difference between the two radically different viewpoints is that one deals with the street and the other with political elites. The meteoric capacity to produce, communicate, and use information is affecting every area of national and international security, from the way we govern ourselves to the way we fight wars, to the way transnational criminal organizations increase in size, scope, and power, to the way global dissenters organize. Prior to 9/11, there were roughly 15 pro-Al-Qaeda websites. Today, there are over 4,000. The leap we're in the process of making is far greater than the one that took us from the Wright brothers in 1903 to the landing on the moon, because that was only 66 years. Also from the time that bombs were being dropped by hand from biplane aircraft in World War I to the time we dropped the big one on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was only 28 years. Mercifully, Bill Joy's famous essay titled "Why the Future Doesn't Need Us" has not found too many takers in the scientific community. The intelligence community in this city numbers roughly 100,000 professionals divided among 15 agencies. I'm talking about Greater Washington. There are another 100,000 in Europe divided among some 100 agencies, and yet we all managed to get it wrong on Iraq. It seems to me that less reliance on the 180,000 documents our government stamps top secret every day, or almost 66 million a year, and more attention paid to open sources and history might have been quite different. If a radical government emerges in Baghdad, either because the U.S. falters in the effort or because Iraq falls into terrorist chaos, the entire Islamic world will find itself in turmoil. Moderate Islamic governments would then topple or struggle for sheer survival. countries with substantial Islamic minorities, such as India, the former Soviet republics, and the Philippines, will become embroiled in chaos, as would European countries with large Muslim communities. What is widely seen throughout the world as unprovoked U.S. aggression against Iraq and the mistreatment of prisoners at Abu Ghraib and the death of some 30,000 Iraqi civilians have radicalized many in the Arab world and among Europe's minorities and elevated Osama bin Laden from a fringe figure to a global leader opposed to what they perceive to be U.S. hegemony in the Middle East. Open source intelligence saw that Iraq served as a recruitment poster for al-Qaeda and the Iraqi insurgency, a sort of melting pot for jihadis from around the world that has energized the global network of Islamist terrorists and its seldom mentioned support group. From Morocco to Cairo to Mindanao, across the entire Muslim world, we have asked moderate, pro-Western heads of state and government to estimate the number of Islamist extremists in their populations. The answer invariably is 1%. Well, that's 1.5 million people in Pakistan, or a worldwide total of 12 million. Fundamentalists who sympathize with them are usually estimated at 10%, that's 120 million. Some European countries, like the Netherlands, encompass a multitude of movements, organizations, groups, tiny. About 20 different hardline Islamist groups or cells have been identified, but I have a very important Dutch specialist in our midst this morning who may correct me. Some of these groups are small as 4 or 5. It is much the same picture among angry young Muslims all over Europe. A survey of 1,160 recent French converts to Islam found that 23% of them identified themselves as Salafists, a Muslim sect associated with violent extremism, as you know, and closely related to Wahhabism. In London, the authorities believe as many as 3,000 veterans of al-Qaeda training camps over the years were born or raised in Britain. A poll after last July's seven bombings in London shows about 100,000 British Muslims in favor of the subway and bus attacks. That same percentage applied to the entire continent would show several hundred thousand survivors. In Pakistan, a coalition of 6 political religious parties governs 2 of the country's 4 provinces, occupies 25% of the seats in the Federal Assembly, and its leaders are proud of their personal friendship with bin Laden. I've heard it personally from these leaders. What would happen to Pakistan's nuclear arsenal if this pro-Taliban coalition achieved a majority in next year's elections? Open sources tell us, or will tell you, what their leaders are saying, both at town hall meetings and in the Urdu press. Retired General Hamid Ghul, a man who hates America with a passion, is a former director of ISI, the Pakistani CIA, who has been a strategic advisor, that's his official title, to the religious parties since 9/11. He is the prototype of a value-added open source and had no compunction describing, for my benefit, future plans for rebuilding the caliphate with a nuclear Pakistan and a post-royal family, Saudi Arabia, as its cornerstone. I'm a frequent traveler to Pakistan, where open sources provided clues to the famous or infamous Dr. A.Q. Khan's nuclear Walmart 10 years before the intelligence community in the U.S. and the U.K. managed to nail it down. These may be the last moments in history to keep nuclear proliferation from spinning out of control. North Korea may well find the temptation to trade nuclear material with terrorist groups for foreign exchange irresistible. Iran, not short of hard currency, has found Islamic justifications for acts of terrorism, such as the killing of 241 U.S. Marines and 58 French soldiers in Beirut, October 23, 1983. 3 months before 9/11, I asked Lee Kuan Yew, the founder of modern Singapore and the Henry Kissinger of the Orient, what he saw as the greatest threat in his geopolitical viewfinder, and he replied without a moment's hesitation, an Islamist bomb, and mark my words, it will travel. Enough from me, and now to hear from Tom Sanderson, my brilliant young deputy on my left, who has been both the architect and the builder of the CSIS open source project as the missing dimension of classified intelligence. Tom and I traveled to Europe together, Middle East, North Africa, Canada, and different parts of the United States to interview about 170 former and current heads of intelligence and security, as well as experts in the private sector. In each one of these off-the-record conversations, we heard an enthusiastic endorsement of open source intelligence. And neither Tom nor I could have possibly done anything without the truly invaluable input of the third member of this team, John McGaffin, on the right of Judge Webster, who has had a remarkable career in the intelligence world and as special advisor to the head of the FBI. Tom, it's yours.
Great. Thank you, Arno. Let me just pop that off. And thank you, too, John, for making such a great contribution. We were only three of a larger group of people that helped us with this project, and I'd like to just recognize them now, not individually, but that was the core advisor group to this effort here, who for more than a year gave us their time on at least a monthly basis, if not more frequently, to give us their opinions and feedback on this effort. So thank you so much for really making this report possible and for making the second phase possible. I'd like to start off by saying a few words about the scope of this effort. There are a lot of efforts now looking at open source. There are basically two main channels that I can see. One that looks at bringing in outside human expertise into this issue, and another that looks at the data mining, looks at the information, how to manage that vast array of news and information and sources out there. And that's largely being taken control of by governments, and our effort is looking at the human side of this, the human factor. Throughout this report, of course, we could refer to three major investigations of intelligence failures that also helped generate this. The 9/11 Commission report in 2004, also in 2004 is the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act, and the 2005 Rob Silberman report. All of them stated in no uncertain terms that open source information was unexploited or underexploited and certainly overlooked to our detriment. This particular project at CSIS began by looking at the need for not at open source information sharing, but at multilateral intelligence sharing. That was the original focus, the original remit of this study, to confront the problem that we were faced with following the March 11, 2004 Madrid bombings, as well as other issues. And that is, future attacks like the Madrid attack would have terrorists who would be operating in multiple countries and would be in parts being looked at by security services from multiple nations who would not be sharing information and intelligence to the degree that they probably should be. So we looked at how do we bring this together, how do we get countries to share information and sensitive intelligence. Unfortunately, this works well in theory and not so well in practice. So soon after beginning the project with that notion in mind and believing that the urgency of the terror threat could make such sharing a possibility, Arno and I, John and the core group, quickly came to realize that that was a bridge too far. And this is notwithstanding what's going on in Paris and in some other cities where there is some multilateral sharing between Western intelligence agencies and security services. 3 months into our project, Arno mentioned the number of people that we interviewed for this, former security chiefs, intelligence chiefs, non-governmental specialists, immigration specialists, cultural anthropologists, journalists, human rights workers. We interviewed an incredibly wide array of individuals. And then we gathered about 30 or 40 of them in Oslo in October of 2004 to consider these issues. And what quickly emerged was that while multilateral intelligence sharing was ahead of its time, networked open source information sharing was an idea whose time had come. We reset the project focus and sought the best guidance on using open source information for this aim, not to provide actionable intelligence for intelligence services, but to provide context, perspective, and understanding on terrorism for all those who are trying to study it, write about it, counter it, and understand it. So again, looking at the wide array of users of information on terrorism as opposed to single government use for classified intelligence. This recalibration culminated in an eye-opening workshop that we held in Brussels last year in May, where CSIS tested the notion that people from non-governmental worlds and expertise could bring their own experience, their own networks into a dynamic, interactive setting and produce insights that governments simply could not generate with the heavy reliance on classified intelligence. So we used a scenario-based exercise, and I see some of the members of that that exercise here today, looking at Islamist extremists from Europe who had gone to Iraq to fight and then would return at some point with, urban combat skills, bomb miniaturization skills, networking, explosives, finance connections, all of those skills that they're learning in this Jihad stadium in Iraq, bringing that back to Europe. That was the scenario that we used. And we rapidly generated, just in a couple hours, some very, very good insights from this group of 20 to 30 people from largely non-governmental fields who helped us scale this problem and look at how we could better approach it. This group in Brussels also did a tremendous service for us by helping us flesh out three or four important building blocks to developing an open-source trusted information network, which was the eventual largest finding of our study. What they helped us do was suggest non-governmental individuals, candidates for an open-source trusted information network, suggestions of relevant professions and areas of expertise that could be brought in to address an issue such as the returnees from Iraq, suggestions of relevant organizations to consult or partner with on a trusted information network. Who else can you pull expertise and perspective from? And also great suggestions on open sources that they would consult for information on the threat presented in the scenario. Among this group were some former intelligence folks, and we would say, you know, we would ask them, where would you get information? Where would you hope to get information? How would you go about it if, in the course of your work, classified intelligence was not going to, I hate to say it, but connect the dots? And so they gave us great suggestions and said, we would want to go outside and we would want to access these individuals. And some of those individuals were in that room, and it was really quite a nice mix of people. And the results were very quick and pretty compelling. CSIS took this valuable feedback and began constructing a trusted information network. That has been accomplished, and following this morning's roundtable, we kick off that network of individuals with individuals who have flown in from several countries to commence an online, moderated, and guided discussion on the roles, activities, and impact of Islamist extremists on European security. That will be the subject of our Phase 2 study. The first one was scoping the problem, looking at open source information. The next phase is actually standing up this trusted information network that officially begins today, and we will share open source, publicly available information only on that subject, the role, impact, and activities of Islamist extremists on European security. So you all have a copy of the report in front of you. I'm not going to read verbatim the findings, but if you turn to the findings, Roman numeral 6, the findings that you'll see in the forward. I want to just run through them briefly and give you a few comments on some of the findings, and then we'll move on. See, the first one there speaks about government counterterrorism efforts that cannot be properly applied to this particular threat without the understanding and perspective and context that comes in from the outside world. And this is not just expertise we're talking about in the United States. This is worldwide. And so maybe we're not reversing the roles where classified intelligence was always king and open source was always an adjunct. We're at least elevating open source to that level. Roman numeral 6. Second finding, there remains a failure to recognize the new unbounded forces of international terrorism. This is the problem we've all been dealing with. It's a subject that few people really have a deep understanding of, and that expertise is resident across databases. It's across universities, across different professions, different levels of expertise in many, many countries, and that the continued use of legacy systems and constructs and perspectives when considering terrorism is not going to get us to where we want to be, helping to prevent the next attack. Finding number 3 on military intelligence and law enforcement agencies remaining at the vanguard and doing a tremendous amount of work and putting in a lot of effort, but still remaining the primary focus of government efforts and showing a lack of comprehensive outreach to these folks. There's not enough expertise in intelligence, law enforcement, and military communities. These areas that we look at for terrorism, from cultural anthropology to Islamic history to immigration movements, these are areas of expertise that were never primary areas of interest within the intelligence community, but they have been the primary area of interest of individuals around the world who've spent their life looking at these issues. And those are the people that need to be brought into this, and not just to help governments, but to help people who are studying it, people who are writing about it, anyone who's involved in understanding and countering terrorism. And John, please feel free to jump in at any point here, because I know you have some good comments on these. The fourth finding, an effort to engage open source non-governmental expertise, as we just described, again, not to provide actionable intelligence where a terrorist is going to be on what street and at what time. That is not what this effort is about. It's about explaining the street, explaining why the terrorist is there, providing context and perspective. It's giving that broader picture so that an analyst, an author, a scholar can look at a fuller picture for what is going on and make a better judgment as to what some of the trends are, where we can see things possibly going in the future. Finding number five, looking at the intelligence community being aware of open source. This is not the first time people in the intelligence community have heard of open source. Many, many years we've had discussions with Judge Webster, with other individuals who go back in the intelligence community many years. They've always known that open source can provide good value, but the point is upping that to a much more significant degree now, realizing that that is where so much more the value added is for understanding terrorism. But that is an important distinction here that we want to make. This is not about providing actionable intelligence. It's about providing information. I would also say one comment on one of these findings is that while this is known by members in the intelligence community, legacy rules about and security rules about engaging folks by going onto the Internet, by going out and making a phone call to Sidney Jones of the International Crisis Group, who knows more about Jamaat Islamiyah than anyone does, and the restrictions around accessing this expertise are very tight. And you have to choreograph any of these interactions to such a degree that it really slows down your efforts to bring this expertise in. So some of those legacy systems and security rules are debilitating and preventing, I think, a more improvement on this issue. And then finally, unlike in the Cold War, that value-added information or intelligence on today's threat does rely outside of U.S. borders. We simply cannot bring in the kind of power that we had in the Cold War. We were not omnipotent, but we really led the charge during the Cold War. We had the technology. We were able to cover the Soviet Union and its related threats. But now, today, we do not have that omnipotent capability. We have to go outside to these agents on the periphery, these individuals who have the kind of expertise in the careers that can make that difference. John, if you have any comments you'd like to make to that.
Just one observation as you look at those lists of the recommendation findings of the study. The one element I think that we perhaps missed as we tried to put it in perspective for you is the element of the criticality and the urgency of this. This is not in the realm of a nice-to-have and elective that will somehow over years be able to move open source into an appropriate role, not just for intelligence but more broadly for understanding the problems that face us. This is here and now, and governments are developing and following policies which without the basis, the benefit of the kinds of understanding and depth of context that this kind of activity provides are going to continue to be ill-founded. So this is not something that we can say we'll get to it, that it's the world of think tanks, but it's the world of all of us to bring this understanding together on a very critical, very urgent basis. And if we don't do it, we're going to continue to suffer the kinds of ill-gotten policies and ill-gotten approaches that we now have.
To continue here, I'd like to actually have you turn to page 18 to look at a chart that I think explains part of the problem, or actually the large part of the problem, very well. And if I can pick on David Kay, he actually came up with this chart during our Brussels event, and I'd like to thank him for doing that. But it puts it in a very digestible form, and that's the chart at the bottom of page 18. And I think it's very telling that highlights why open source can play such an important role in confronting one of the central threats that we have to global security today, and conversely, why too much emphasis on classified intelligence can be hobbling. As our second finding states, following 9/11, the U.S. reached into its quiver for the tools that it had built up over 40, 50 years of confronting the Soviet Union. You immediately reach for the tools you have, the tools you know, the tools you spent billions, if not trillions, of dollars on over that Cold War period. they were for fighting the Soviets, and now we're trying to turn them on a somewhat amorphous al-Qaeda and threat from Islamist extremism. And in so many ways, it's been unwise and counterproductive. I'll give you just one example, the overemphasis on using the military, a blunt instrument that has led to some abuses, such as Abu Ghraib, that has added to our problem. And this is a result of using legacy tools, legacy constructs to face this problem. I'll just conclude and allow 15, 20 minutes of questions by saying that our study looked at open source information not from an angle of more effective mining of databases, again, to reiterate that point, which is something of great importance, but is something that is being covered by governments at this point. But at the other side of this coin, looking at expertise, the role of non-governmental experts in our efforts to provide, again, the context and understanding, the world around the actual intelligence. Their expertise can identify developments that we would not expect secret intelligence to have caught, but whose existence, the developments, are important as important as the other issues. These are surprises known well or better by folks in the open source world. Government's inability to see these developments are not necessarily a failure of intelligence services, but they are surprises that officials have to be concerned with. So these are surprises out there that government intelligence analysts are not going to pick up, but which the expertise can, and these are surprises that need to be known by governments and by others who are looking at the threat of terrorism. Open source information and trusted information networks can help illuminate these, the individuals that you see around this room, and make a real impact on those in and out of government involved in countering transnational terrorism. I'll turn it back to Arno and open it up for questions.
Thanks, Tom, and I hope we will now have an interesting discussion. I see a few hands up. Harlan Ullman.
Arno, thank you. First, what you've done is God's work, and I congratulate you. But let me ask about phase two, because I think what you're saying is not only long overdue and necessary, the question is implementation. And what concerns me is that we are dealing with what I would call the Dubai port world fiasco, in which facts no longer count, in which you're dealing with ideology and partisanship, and assuming that your open source really gets to the heart of the matter, and knowing you so long and so well enough, Arno, I know it will, how do you get governments to listen? I mean, you go back during your career, many of these things were known from the earliest days of the Soviet Union until al-Qaeda, yet they have been consistently ignored throughout our history. How do you take what you have and really have impact in getting people to understand in this politically charged environment?
Thank you, Harlan. It seems to me that President Bush, when instead of saying, I will veto any resolution that comes down from the Hill on Dubai ports, it seems to me it was so easy to say that there are 15 important ports in the United States. They have about 100 terminals between them, and only 8 are American-owned because we don't have a merchant marine. We've allowed that to disappear. And your terminals are tied or linked directly to the size of your merchant fleet around the world. As for getting governments to listen, I concede your point. It is extremely difficult given the fact that in a democracy, if you tell the people the truth, you can't get yourself reelected.
Harlan, I would just add to that that there's no doubt about it, this is a challenge, but we're hoping that the actual conduct of this trusted information network will produce the kind of insights that we hope governments and others will say, wow, why didn't we know that? And the answer is, well, because you're not engaging this kind of human expertise that's outside of the U.S. and outside of government. So when we lay that down in front of anyone, because this is a publicly available report, we want people to hopefully recognize that there's very high added value.
Really force the politicians to listen from town hall meetings to other sorts of fora. And if you haven't, I really would urge them to. You've got the internet, you've got all sorts of access right now. It just seems to me that this sort of information is really critical to impose upon the political leadership so they cannot run away from it, irrespective of whether they're elected.
Harold, are you shaking your head? Thank you.
May I add a moment on? I think, and as you get to this, the notion of this phase two that begins today, and it moves to a more sort of a bottom-up thing. If, as Tom said, the premise is that by proceeding this way, there's going to be a wealth of information that will be of such value and such importance to analysts and others as we go forward that they will be compelled, just to do their job better, just as the sociologists and the anthropologists will do, to do their jobs better, that it will inform what they do. On the way up to the more difficult problem that you point to of how do you make the politicians understand that from in perhaps in conflict with their preconceived ideas, that's another problem. But this is about so seeding the universe in which analysts work that it becomes these new views become inescapable.
Dr. Chuck Cogan is next.
I'm encouraged by this meeting because I haven't heard this politically correct inanity, the global war on terrorism. I think the first thing we should do is know thine enemy. Thine enemy is Islamist radicalism, and I'm glad to hear Arno particularly bring this out this morning.
Thank you. Next. Yes.
One of the things that you might consider that seem to be very important is the role of scientists in the academe. There are a lot of reservations about getting involved in any of this. For one thing, most of the open source information is theoretically worthless. And unless it's vetted in a very specific way and verified and reliable, it's less than worthless. All the stuff that's out there for the scientific community, and I suspect most of the classified stuff, is incident-based databases, which can tell us nothing about who becomes a terrorist, why, how do they radicalize, what motivates them, why do some of them defect. And some way to convince governments that the scientific community, the university community, can add value to these open sources, you have to engage them in some interesting way. And one of the very important things to do is how to structure open source information, how to make it reliable, and how to prevent the universities from getting lawsuits by putting any kind of information out there on the line. I mean, IRBs won't give approval even to do databases.
Thank you very much for that very useful intervention. Yes, sir.
I have a question. You know, in the academic world, the people love to write long papers. Coming back to the idea to present your extract to the politicians, do you have already an idea how you will make out of, let's say, 30 pages, one page, which has the most important information in it, and how you will present it?
Thanks, Peter. I appreciate your input all along the way. CSIS has been around for 45 years, roughly, I think, and has a tremendous record of getting report findings in front of legislators and policymakers. And we have a tremendously good board and good leadership at CSIS that briefs these at the highest levels to the relevant committees, to the NSC, to anyone who's concerned with the particular issue. So we do get a lot of face time in front of the people who are responsible for making changes when they read good information. Of course, there are about a million hurdles along the way, but nonetheless, CSIS has a tremendous track record of turning reports into action, into legislation.
And if you take the non-Lugard legislation and relate it to what we did here at CSIS, I directed a program called the Nuclear Black Market at the suggestion of then-Senator, still-Senator Sam Nunn, who's now chairman of our Board of Trustees. And that has triggered, since then, $12 billion in non-Lugar authorization to try to enhance the security of the nuclear storage sites and nuclear material sites in the former Soviet Union. I've just mentioned that example, but there are many where you will see a direct link between what we do here and what happens up on the Hill. Please.
Whoops, there we go. As you go into phase two, do you have any plans to enlist as part of the working groups involved active people from the Hill or the White House to join with non-government organizations of various kinds to try to lay out some sort of a model or set of model approaches to how this sort of thing can be organized and implemented?
The first iteration of the Trusted Information Network is non-governmental only. Of course, we, as a constant feature of our work at CSIS, we're always briefing government officials on our findings on developments. But this is non-governmental only. But when we set this out more than a year ago, we looked at three potential forms of it. One that is completely non-governmental to allow much more freedom of thinking and to bring in individuals who would not normally or ever would want to do anything directly related to governments. And then another iteration with some government involvement, providing some guidance as to things that might be of interest to them. And then actually one of the eventual goals we hope to reach is that governments set up their own trusted information networks of outside individuals and work directly with them. So this first iteration, non-governmental only. But CSIS has a tremendous amount of access to governments, and we share our findings with people. John?
That's a key point, and I think we all agreed that it was a bridge too far at the start to try to bring all this together. But I think one of the findings of phase two must answer the question of how do you bring them together? My view, personally McGaffin's view, is simply that we're creating a universe in which all may play in the sense of anthropologists, sociologists, government people having access and sort of an equal basis to the dialogue that goes on. And then the sociologist goes back and writes what sociologists write, or and the government analyst goes back and does what combines what it already knows with that. That, I think, is the outcome, but that's prejudging it. But that must be the end of our survey when we address that issue. But it's the key issue.
Yes, thank you. Just actually following up from John's point earlier about this is about the here and now. This isn't a sort of theory. It's something that's terribly important. Is there a sense from the European governments that whose countries essentially are the key focus of this study? Is there a sense from them that they are going to find an automatic? Are they going to be automatically responsive to these findings? I'm wondering about how you're going to feed what is learned into those governments that, to all intents and purposes, are really on the front line. Obviously, the focus has been on what people in Washington will think, but you know, obviously, Washington is that distance away, and so on and so forth.
I'm sure Arno has some comments on this, but as you know, and others in here know, that the content of our Trusted Information Network includes quite a few top individuals from Europe who are influential in their writings and in their own networks with governments, individuals from the Middle East and North Africa. But in our Brussels event last year, we had the director of the European Union Situation Center attend that, and he was very excited about our work, and we plan to keep him abreast of the developments. And we also have a number of other inroads into European governments that were pre-existing to this project, and so that's how we intend. I am sure that we're going to face the same problems that Harlan Ullman brought up, and especially with trying to get Brussels to, you know, accept anything in wholesale or even universally. But we have already established some inroads with governments there and security services and non-governmental points of contact.
I'll just add to that. Go ahead.
I just direct your attention to the quote that appears at the top of page one of the report. Let me just read it to you because it's a comment to demonstrate that we've tried to engage some people who have had some experience here. One of the participants in our project at an early conference said, "I used to think when I worked in the intelligence services that government was always saying, go and get us a pail of water on the subject of terrorism. We're thirsty and we want a drink. And I would look outside my office and see only mist." So they're focused.
From the president of the Belgian Senate to one of the ministers in Canada, I mean, it was unanimous everywhere we went. They felt that this is something that they were looking forward to using and to understanding. And even though this has been around a long time, no one has ever thought of bringing it together the way this team has.
And I would also say, Mark, the preponderance of our interviews occurred in Europe, as well as Morocco. So we interviewed, you know, well over 100 individuals in Europe, you know, fairly evenly split between government and non-government. So we've got a good focus there.
Rob Quartel, former U.S. Federal Maritime Commissioner. My company is very involved in crunching open source data for container security. One of the things I'm having a hard time here with is actually seeing how the rubber meets the road. A lot of this seems to me to be long-term and strategic, which is fine. But there is also a preemptive tactical forensic use for a lot of open source information as well. And I guess one of the things that makes me think about that is in the last week there was an article, I think, in the New York Times about the fashion industry, which monitors blogs. And there are something like 3 million blogs in the United States for information about trends. And they don't wait 6 months or a year or 3 months to figure out how to use it. They use it immediately. So I guess my long question is, have you thought about the tactical use of this?
Very much so, and you'll be hearing all about blogs and how all of this is changing the name of the game from Dick O'Neill and Jeff Jonas in a few minutes.
Great.
Yeah, on a couple points, both the possible iterations or uses for trusted information networks and involvement of the Europeans in their response to this idea and potential tactical development of tactical information. I thought it was interesting at the meeting in Oslo, the initial conversation that started the morning was a discussion about multilateral intelligence sharing, or at least information sharing, but sort of between governments. And there was a distinct chill in the room and some clearly articulated comments of expressing a real mistrust, I think particularly of what the United States would do with information that was provided by its, you know, by European governments. And it was then that we started to shift to this notion of a trusted information network and building and a recognition that you begin building trust at the individual level, not at the governmental level. That individuals build trust, and then hopefully their institutions begin to build trust, and then perhaps their governments begin to build trust. And so there was a fair amount of discussion at that meeting about the possibility eventually, someday, building a kind of trusted information network among the individuals in governments, whether in law enforcement or intelligence, who are pursuing these objectives and these targets. And there was a real potential, there was a real recognition around the table of the potential there for developing tactical information by sharing similar kinds of things that you're seeing in a real-time way in a secure network.
That's great, Suzanne. You have a terrific memory. I've reached an age now where, unfortunately, my secrets are now safe with my friends because they can't remember them either.
I'm sure you've thought about this, but I wanted to reemphasize in terms of trying to inoculate people. One of the good things that happened in Iraq was something called companycommander.com, in which the junior officers were able to expand all sorts of information. The Army was ambivalent about it because, on the one hand, they didn't want it to happen. On the other hand, they thought it might work, and so they put some money into it. I'm sure you thought about this, but you might want to consider coming up with things like companycommander.com or intel.com, where you can bring in people who are on the inside, but in some kind of a network, as we did in Iraq, because it seems to me this is the best way to get open source information out and debate it.
I'd like to make one response to Rob's comment. We mentioned the different iterations that we're thinking about. This one is non-governmental with no direct link or ability for the intel community to tap it for, you know, tactical information on a day-to-day basis. But in that version that we talked about, where we hope governments will look at our model and say, okay, this is the great kind of expertise we should be bringing in, that they are able to convince 10, 20, 30 people to establish a trusted info network on proliferation, terrorism, whatever it is, and then they can make an arrangement where they do tap them for that tactical information. But in this one, it's not set up that way.
And to follow up on what Tom said, so looking ahead, the year from now, not only would the successors to this project look for ways that government can tap in to information, but I think that the rest of the players in this universe have a right to expect that if you want to tap in, you got to play in. You know, where's the U.S. government putting, if in this world, in this universe, putting the output of FBIS into availability for the people who are interested in whatever the subject may be, in this case terrorism? What are the other things in terms of databases that the governments do. They do, you know, LexisNexis on steroids. That's a function of large government. Where do they put this in? Where is their responsibility if there is a reciprocal here between government and private sector? You know, you want to come and be part of this, you've got to put something into government. So I think that's a follow-on, you know, where, as we start to think of the end of this, how you make this better or different.
I mean, there's a lot of talk, a lot of discussion about using this, but we actually wanted to say, hey, we need an example, a demonstrator for what non-governmental experts can bring to this challenge of terrorism, and so we're doing it. We started today.
We thought that the Trusted Information Network on potato growing in Massachusetts wouldn't have the same currency as this.
Open source information is critical. Dick O'Neill is the founder and president of the Highlands Group, which is arguably the most important cross-disciplinary forum of out-of-the-box and over-the-horizon leaders from industry, academia, government, the arts, and the professions. Themes and ideas emerging from Highlands Group forum meetings have been indispensable in supporting high-level government policy and strategy development, particularly focusing on information and information technologies and their impact on international relations, economics, and security. I'll get out of the way in a minute for the presentation. Dick O'Neill previously served in government in his last position as Deputy for Strategy and Policy in the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Defense, and I was privileged to speak at his retirement ceremony after 29 years in the U.S. Navy. He has briefed public and private sector leaders on a very broad range of topics, including CSIS, the Presidential Commission on Diplomacy, the Presidential Commission on Critical Infrastructure Protection, the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, and he has lectured at universities all over the United States and in many other countries. Jeff Jonas is Chief Scientist of the Entity Analytics Solutions Group and an IBM Distinguished Engineer. The IBM Entity Analytics Solutions Group was created based on technologies developed by Jeff's company, Systems Research and Development, SRD, which was acquired by IBM in January of 2005. The most recent breakthrough developed by Jeff involves a privacy-enhancing technology, providing extraordinary new levels of privacy protection while enabling technology to contribute to critical societal interests like clinical health care research, aviation safety, homeland security, fraud detection, and identity theft. Jeff's innovations have received worldwide coverage in a wide variety of publications, including The Wall Street Journal, Fortune, Computer World, and The Washington Post. He has been featured in ABC Primetime with the late Peter Jennings, the Discovery Channel, the Learning Channel, and other networks. He is a very popular speaker on technology, security, and privacy, and has spoken at numerous functions, government and private, all over the world. Dick, will you please kick it off, and we will get out of your way.
Thanks, Arno. If you look at the title of our presentation, actually, on your sheet. It says the future of open source, blogs, networks, and technology. I'd probably like to make a couple of changes. It would be future is hard to tell whether that is near future or distant future, and you can decide after you've heard Jeff and me talk. But I would say that we're talking about networks. We're talking about not just technology networks, information networks, but also social networks, and that may be actually more important. And technology really is meaning low, medium, and high technology, as you'll see when we get through, I think. This particular presentation is called The Long Tail, and for those who aren't terribly familiar with power laws of distribution, that's what this is. But I promise this will not be about formulas to show you the derivation of a long tail, power law of distribution. This comes from Chris Anderson, who is the editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine, and his new book will be out in about another 2 months called The Long Tail. It's part of an effort that we've had underway for the last 2 years in the Highlands Forum, sponsored by the Secretary of Defense, that's been dealing with the overall topic, I think, would be connectedness, content, and security, and what that really means in a world where connectedness seems to be growing day by day. We went from there to look at the Defense Science Board's report on transition from hostilities and also the report on strategic communications into a forum that we sponsored just a few months ago that a few people here were present for called Strategic Listening. And I think we'll borrow a little bit from each of those, but primarily from the last forum on strategic listening, which we found to be the unspoken, unimportant element of the spectrum of communication on strategic communications, because listening was what we'd forgotten about. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this long tail. And the long tail can probably be described very simply if you think about an XY axis and then a big spike, and then the curve comes down along the axis, asymptotic, all the way out. What that really shows you is distribution of elements, for example, in sales of books. If you think about the top 100 bestsellers, they're all up here at the spike. That's what you buy. That's what you know about. But there's a long curve, a long tail, underneath which are the sales of all other books. And quite frankly, there aren't many sales of some of those books. But if you look at the aggregate of the sales of those books under the curve, they actually far exceed the spike at the head of the curve. Why is that? Well, by and large, over the years, most stores only had a certain amount of shelf space to carry a certain number of titles. But with the democratization of tools, thinking things like the Internet and Amazon.com, you see referential kinds of things. So if you saw somebody bought Mike Scheuer's book, other people who bought this book also read or also bought. And you see referential aspects out. So the list of other titles continues to grow. We have next. You got it there, Jeff. So there are three forces in driving what we call the long tail. First is that democratized tool of production. You have that one, Jeff. Second is the lowered cost of consumption, and that democratizes the tools of distribution. And you think of the Internet here. Third one is the ability to connect customers to interesting niche products in the tail. And what happens is those particular products get elevated beyond what they normally would have expected to be. So what we're seeing under that curve is a shift, maybe a shift in interest and consumption, but certainly a shift in influence and power, perhaps, under the curve from institutions to individuals, because that's really what's under that curve. Individuals who put out a vanity press book, or who put out their journal or their blog or photographs. It's a very interesting mix of things where people are sharing information with others underneath that curve. So if we think about, and I'll come to this in another slide in a few minutes, if you think about from my perspective, when we started to talk about strategic listening, strategic listening means to me, who are we hearing? By and large, who are we hearing? So if we thought back to 30 or 40 years ago, we had three networks, we had three newscasts on at the same time. And if you turned your dial from station to station, you probably would see almost the same story, almost at the same time on each of the networks, just a different flavor by a different network anchor. And you could choose your anchor who you felt closest represented your particular interest. Underneath that tail, you would probably find a number of people who wanted to somehow communicate with others but were unable to because the technology didn't allow that, nor did the power relationships allow other people to really be heard. So we added a few more in there, not just the networks, but the major dailies, the certain journals, the university peer-reviewed journals. There were those things that made up what we call the information elite. Those were the things that we bought and we listened to, and that was where we got conventional wisdom, by and large. I think that what we've learned is that if we listen to what's under the curve, if we pay attention, and I think I heard Arno talk about this morning, this is more about the street than the elites. Think that when you think what's under the curve. Again, what's under the curve, the population of people who wish to communicate with each other, with you, far exceeds that which is in the head of the spike. What are the lessons that we learned from that? Well, we thought when we did our session for the Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State last year that perhaps strategic listening was under that curve. So if we found a way to somehow connect the people or to give them the tools of production underneath that curve, that you would end up with an extraordinarily dense and rich amount of information which we could draw on. What do we learn from that? Well, I think it was Suzanne who mentioned that trust was a critical issue this morning. Peers trust peers. And in an age where we find trust in institutions diminishing by the day, peers trust peers. It conveys authenticity. We talk about ants up here in the slide as having megaphones. Well, that's maybe not a very good way to do it. But in terms of scale, these people are ants compared to the output of networks. But they're individuals. They have megaphones. If I talk to you, if we talk to each other, if we talk beyond into a network that's local that becomes regional, a couple of things happen. One is perhaps the rest of the world listens in, or at least the rest of the local region listens in. But a social dynamic perhaps also gets created by people having a voice when they had no voice before. Third thing that happens is you can't control the conversation. You can't, I can't, governments can't. One of the best examples of this happened with Milosevic trying to turn off Radio B92. Those of you who know the story of the radio station that played not just popular music, but also had all the news of the recent demonstrations that were ongoing that were a threat to him. And he pulled the plug on them. So they moved to another location. He managed to pull the plug on them again. They went to the university, and he pulled the plug on them again. So they moved outside the borders of the country, using the telephone system to put their information, broadcasting the radio station's music and news on the internet. And there was no way that he could turn off the telephone system. So they were able to get their message out, and they were actually quite successful. The point is, again, here, you can't control the conversation. So what's in the head? As I described, there are all kinds of burgeoning networks, broadcasts that are vying for share. And if you look at the numbers these days, most networks are losing share. Television networks, the big three, are certainly losing it. Cable has a growing share, but it's still small. Television in general is down. What else is up? Well, certainly the internet is up. Gaming is up. A whole variety of things are up. But it's this constant battle for attention. We're back to looking at what gets my attention on a daily basis, and that's where advertising is looking. That's how Google succeeds. They succeed by advertising, looking for your eyeballs. So if we're looking for where to get information, we can certainly get it from any of these particular providers. You can see the Financial Times, the New York Times, Al Jazeera, Radio Africa, and Television Africa, which is new, Telesur from South America, which is becoming a threat to some already here because of the voice of Chavez, Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, but they're all broadcasting. There's very little in the way of sharing of information. VOA actually has an interesting program underway right now because they've learned that the largest most watched program in the Middle East, daytime television program, is actually Oprah Winfrey. And it's fascinating because people want to see other people talk about problems like they have. Whether they're in the same culture or in different cultures, they want to see what people think and what they're talking about with regard to their problems. So VOA has an interesting program run by Avi Davidi a couple of times a week. They broadcast by television into Iran, and then they get talk show call-ins. And people are calling in not from Los Angeles and the Iranian communities or from London. They're getting calls via cell phone from villages. They're getting calls from Tehran. And these are disintermediated. They are calls beyond the control of the government. They get to call in and talk to a U.S. policymaker. The oddest thing was the day that I went down to see this program, the guest that was being interviewed by Avi was Bud McFarlane. I was trying to knock on the window to ask, so what was up with that cake and that Bible? I couldn't get the question answered. But it was a fascinating thing to watch Bud be interviewed by people in Iran directly.
Jeff?
So we have these constituencies then with pent-up demand. How do we look at the different constituencies that we want to identify, that we want to listen to, not talk to necessarily, but listen to? The colors are a little bit oversaturated here, but I think you can see that you have women, youth, you have people from the Middle East, from Asia, from Africa, who are connected in many ways. And it's not just about the internet. Next, Jeff. So we've got this content and connectedness under the curve. If you look at some of the pictures, if you can make out the detail back there, you'll see everything from people on their blogs, reading internet sites, taking photographs, playing peace games, and those are one-on-one. The point here is that there are any number of low-tech, medium-tech, and high-tech ways of connecting people so they can share their ideas, their thoughts, their expertise, their local knowledge, their street points of view with others who probably aren't used to listening to them. The one that I thought was the most fascinating of all of those was the photograph up here, the little girl taking a picture of another child. This is Zanna Briskie's Born Into Brothels. If you've seen the documentary, it's one of the most remarkable films you probably could ever see, and Zanna won the Oscar for it last year. This is where she went to live in the brothels of Calcutta, brought cameras with her. She had never made a movie before. Went to take pictures of the prostitutes on the line, and turned out that the fascinating story was not about them but about their children, who were considered outcasts, who weren't allowed to go to school because they were the children of criminals. Zanna found that she could teach them some skills, which they never had, raise their expectations and their hopes, and give them a voice. So not only did they take these wonderful pictures, which she then was able to get into exhibitions around the world, but she had her boyfriend come over and start filming. This film is just a stunning documentary about what's possible when you listen to other people. There are now organizations all over the world called kidswithcameras.org, started by Zanna and her company. We can do cameras, we can do blogs, and there's a whole range in between. There's SMSing. There are no shortage of sources of information if we choose to allow people to connect, if we choose to listen, and if we think we're listening for things that we haven't listened to before. So what might the shape of demand look like? This is what the long tail looks like right now. Slight overlay in color, but you can get the sense that perhaps you lower the head and you broaden the tail. So somewhere underneath that tail is where we're looking for the future of context, understanding, and perspective for people who are connected in new ways.
Oh, we've separated our charts.
Yes, you have.
How have we done that? Fascinating. Can you now see
what an IBM chief scientist can do?
Well,
don't put any pressure on you, John.
Hey, there's something going on.
If he had a Mac, it wouldn't be a problem, John.
Well, let's just see what we can do here. Look at that.
You want to go to the...
All of that work we did to make a joint little
chart.
Yeah,
how did you manage to separate them?
How exactly did that
happen? You picked the wrong
one.
You picked the original one. There you go. Okay.
This is great.
Good morning. Well, if we thought we had a lot of data before, we're going to have even more data tomorrow. We probably only have a thimble of data, and we're drowning in it as it is. So I've spent the last 10 years working on systems of scale, whether it be a system that has 4,200 physically different feeds from 4,200 different systems globally, designed to track billions of transactions and hundreds of millions of people, to systems with 20 to 50 billion rows of data and, again, hundreds of millions of people. And when organizations become fascinated with data, they want more. There's always a mystery in there, and to get to the end of the mystery, you just want more. And there's this explosion of data. In fact, my curve here, available data on the left and time on the bottom. Over time, you know, the amount of available data in the world is just exploding. But, you know, actual population growth is only this, you know, has some slope. And in fact, what I think is interesting is that there's only a certain amount of data that's actually new. This came to my attention when one of my customers was getting 100 million rows a month of something one would consider open source data. And every month they would get the 100 million rows again. And they wouldn't quite know what has changed. It's not like it came with an add and change and delete log. And they were only looking at one thing when there were many things like this. So it turns out what's happening, there's this echo effect where data is replicating itself. I know single data sets that in the U.S. replicate 5,000 times in the first month or two. And as we start changing as the tail starts changing because we start sensing blogs and chat rooms, the question I have is, how are we going to address the echo effect? And so what you really need is you need to be able to reduce the noise so you can flush the echo effect so you can count things correctly. And I believe that we're going to see a different echo effect based on different kinds of data. Now, obviously, there's digital and non-digital data. I still would argue that most of the data in the world is not in a digital form. But more is coming. And I think structured data and unstructured data has a different propensity to echo. You know, a phone book will have one propensity. And a newspaper story that gets produced 32 times over in 32 different papers, changing slightly where a paragraph or a sentence is dropped for ad placement, will have a different characteristic. And then there's sensor-based data versus human-constructed. So when somebody's writing a story and publishing that, that's going to create one kind of echo effect versus systems that are out there scanning the world, collecting data. And then there's replicated content where the data in its entirety is being transferred or information shared or passed in its exact form. But then there's when data starts to just breed with itself, it gets altered, it gets synthesized, and people are constructing brand new data by observing other data. And the question that I have is, how will the echo affect the head versus that tail? And skipping through Dick's charts. One scenario would be that the echo effect of the tail can produce as much data as the head. We would want to watch out for that. There's a possible another effect where some parts of the tail, certain kinds of data, have a bigger echo effect than others. And it's probably not this scenario, but this scenario says you're not going to get too much of an echo effect change in open source. And the reason why this is really important to address, if you were to look for signs of graffiti to give one an indicator of the trends in a society, if you're looking at open source, are there seven sources for the report of graffiti, or is there one source that's been reported seven times? And in another set of open source documents, you have 37 named criminal parties. And the question is, if you looked across 10 publications and saw 370 names, if you can't count those right, you're going to have the wrong assessment. And so I worry about being blinded by the light, in this case, open source noise. And therefore, moving forward and in the future, we need to think about echo reduction strategies. And part of that echo, we have to deal with something called the semantic reconciliation of terms or concepts. And what that really is when two people are describing the same thing in different ways. So if one person or set of reporting says graffiti and one says spray-painted gang symbols on buildings, it is the same thing. And being able to see through these things is going to be really critical to maximize the value out of open source intelligence. And now I think we're open for Q&A.
Questions? Yes, sir.
My name is Larry Checo, and I'm not part of the intelligence community at all. I'm a deeply concerned citizen on this issue. And I work in the communications industry, And I do understand that good communication does entail trust. And it's a word that's come up with quite a bit this morning. Two things. Trust in the information that we would collect through this open source. How do you, and this is a double question, how do you distinguish between information and disinformation, number one? And number two, part of my business is I specialize in branding. And I would contend that the United States of America has lost its trusted brand overseas and perhaps domestically as well. In collecting this information and hoping that other people and other nations would share it with the United States, how do we regain that trust so that we can make this a powerful tool rather than, you know, just something else that's out there?
I don't know if I could touch the second question, actually. That may be a bit beyond what we want to even talk about here. But that's a huge problem. Certainly time, certainly actions and policies, you know, being consistent with what we're saying, you know, that takes time. Trust. Well, I mean, we certainly have trust issues when we work with experts. There are those who felt that we drew in those who we wanted to confirm our points of view, preconceived points of view, pre-war, pre-invasion, to justify. You know, I'm not making a value judgment on that. I mean, that is an assertion that's been, you know, fairly widely reported. So what is it that you are looking for in terms of trust? Do you trust somebody who validates what your thinking is? Do you trust information in general and hope that in the aggregate that you can find through winnowing, through all those things, that you do have an alternative point of view or points of view, plural? I would suspect that in volume, that in greater density of information, in the ability to cross-check, that you have a variety of things. Now, that doesn't necessarily connect to the ultimate policy decision. And you can get all the good information you want on the table. And if you choose to make a different policy, you know, decision because it, again, fits your other policies, then it doesn't matter if you had the information or not. So I would say that it's hard to say that you can get worse by having a larger cross-section of information, cross-disciplinary, from voices that you haven't heard before. And I think it probably is more difficult when you have larger amounts of noise and signal to have deception across those. You really have to have extraordinarily well-controlled high volume from single points of input into the information system in order to be able to do significant deception in say, a more globalized, explosive, ballistic sense of information flow and volume. So I think that that's probably less of a concern. But we also, over time, will take a look at which sources we learn to trust. You know, it's a matter of culling through it and then learning to trust.
I'd like to take a really quick stab at the second part of your question. I have this fear that, you know, if you go to the internet and search for September 11th and conspiracy, it is all you read about. And there's a huge portion of the outside world, let's say, where, you know, they have this notion that at 9/11 there was this big conspiracy by the U.S. government to actually let it happen. And if you're in the Arab world, whether you're going to Al Jazeera or whether you're going on to internet search, most of what you read is bad. Talk about tearing down the U.S. brand. You know, and as I sit around and contemplate what one might do about this is, if you massively translated a bunch of things from English to Arabic, just internet content, so that their view through their lens into the open source world, when they went to their Google and searched, gave you a broader distribution of things that weren't so heavily negative, might in fact improve the brand.
I think we encountered that question quite a few times, and John has always had some good responses on that. And after he makes the comment, anyone who asks a question, please make sure you identify yourself and your affiliation. Thanks.
I'm going to go back to the first part of the question again. And it's really key to this whole notion of more integration and use of open source. And particularly from the classified world, you get these people saying, well, how would you know whether to trust it or not? And it sort of assumes that it's either true, the information, is either true or either false. And also falsely assumes or incorrectly assumes that in the classified world things are either true or either false. Well, those of us who've done this, whether it's technical collection and listening to two people talking, one or both of whom may be lying, or sitting with a human source in a safe house someplace, not everything you get from that is either true or false. We have to find a way to say about open source that we're not going to require it to be either true or false, that it adds to, that it adds to in its entirety our understanding of the issue. And I think Dick's right to leave the deception issue aside, because that's just a constant condition. But to get away from thinking of things that they must be either true or false before we can chew on them is just a road that's not going to get us anywhere.
John, if I can on that too. I mean, we're also, remember, we're not just talking about facts. I mean, we're looking at, you know, things that, you know, you'd say true or false. Is this correct? What you're also looking for are attitudes, perceptions, you know, beliefs, because it would be nice to know what it is that people believe before you try to craft a message back to them as well. I mean, that's our whole part of strategic communication. We craft a message that we think we want them to hear, but of course it may not be listened to at the other end. So if you hear what it is that people feel, believe, think, you have an opportunity to create a dialogue by virtue of then getting a message back to them that then creates that dialogue and maybe results in co-creation of something new, if you're willing to move off your position. You know,
yes, sir.
Back to Jeff's point real quickly about the 9/11 conspiracy view in the Muslim world. I guess I would argue, and this is important to how you handle the data you get back, the information, that everything in the Middle East is a conspiracy. And I had a conversation about 2 years ago with one of my business partners in Jordan about the new king and the old king, in which they said the new king travels around a lot. And I said, well, didn't the old one? And they said, yes, but always with guards. And I said, well, he had had assassination attempts. And a very well-educated business partner, who U.S. citizen, Jordanian, said, well, most of us don't think they were really assassination attempts. So everything is a conspiracy, okay? But what that says is that it seems to me that in all of this, you have to distinguish between what people say from what they do, because they are not always the same. And to your point, I'm not sure the brand, core brand value is actually gone, but I do think based on the way people actually act, that I have seen in the Middle East and American things and people and everything else, there is something at the interface, at the GUI. So I guess one question is, how do you distinguish between talking, acting, and beliefs?
Yes. I'm sorry, but I dealt quite a bit in disinformation back in the 80s when I wrote a book about it with my colleague Robert Moss. Disinformation, by definition, must contain a kernel of truth around which you then weave a tissue of falsehoods. And it's devilishly difficult to cope with because they always point to that kernel of truth.
But disinformation is usually deliberate. A lot of what goes on in conversation and blogs and everything else is not deliberate. It's spontaneous and of the moment.
Correct. Only half-joshingly, we frequently welcome our foreign visitors to Washington by saying, welcome to our new bilingual capital where truth is a second language. Seldom spoken, however.
Do we want to have a response on that, or did you want to respond to that?
Well, just briefly, you want to corroborate across sources. You want to, you're not only just looking for what is being said, but you're looking for things that sense what is done. So if somebody tries to invoke a swarm, this is where somebody pushes out on a bunch of pages, we're all going to meet Thursday in front of Goldman Sachs. Everybody shows up there. Whether they say they're going to do that and then whether they really do that, you would look for two different sensor events. And then you'd watch that through time, and that would give you credibility or non-credibility as to whether or not that mechanism is productive.
Thanks, Jeff. David Kay, and folks, questions for all of us up here. Doesn't matter what you have on your mind.
Well, just a quick one on the issue of conspiracy. It's easy for us to fall into the stereotype that the Middle East is nothing but conspiracy without forgetting that it's not uncommon in American society. Those of us of a certain age grew up with grandmothers who believed that FDR allowed the Japanese to attack Pearl Harbor because that was the only way to get in to the conflict. I mean, there is a tendency to stereotype and forget its present. But in fact, observing conspiracy theories is an interesting piece of data. Knowing this is conspiracy. On your last point, the question of devaluing brands, I'll go back again to grandmotherly advice. If you want to get out of a hole, maybe you ought to stop digging. You know, you ought to recognize what, in fact, is devaluing your brand before you start crafting a message to change the attitude, because it's referring to something you're doing that is devaluing it. And unless you recognize that and face that honestly, the best crafted message in the world is going to be zilch.
I think, David, what you were referring to is that the Ten Commandments have now become multiple choice.
Question about the power law, the power law distribution. So I can see where sort of model could reduce, say, the counterterrorism database from, say, 350,000 to, say, an order of magnitude because there's so much repetition in names. But in evolution, we have the problem that evolution is mostly waste. It's mostly echo effects, mostly mirror effects. But all the significant events occur within the echo. That is, it's a mutation, a small mutation in the echo. And that is the source of the next spike. And as we know, wars and terrorist events still follow a parallel distribution. That is, most of the important events in human history, in fact, in stellar history or biological history, are rare, low-probability events. And those can only be found in this sort of echo thing. So how can you be – do you have some way of reducing the echo without losing the message for the next spike? Which I didn't see in that.
So maybe let's take this together because I want to get to a point.
I'll say one word, then you can say one. Let's see what
comes out. Go ahead. Say one first. We'll echo.
Echo.
A fact of life is that people are more connected and communicating more than we've ever seen in the world's history. Okay? I mean, I don't know how many blogs we're talking about here, Arno. You give me a number, and I'll say, sure, that's right. But, I mean, you know, you can say anywhere from 30 million to 70 million. The number of blogs just continues to either grow or just be hyped. I'm not sure what it is. But a lot of those are people talking to themselves or their family. But there are lots more. Communication in general is exploding. If we choose to listen to it as a source for this new open source project, and to determine if there is value in there, if we're able to do something about it, there's no question there's going to be that echo effect that's a huge problem, the one that Jeff, you know, briefed on. What we wanted to make as a key point for this presentation today, and I think we had a slide or two drop off, unfortunately, at the end, which were the cosmic ahas. simple points. One is, there is that world of information, much of which is going to become referential, much of which is going to be locally connected to largely connected, much of which is going to have tactical information, but because of timelines and because of transparency of information in the world, is going to end up having strategic value as well. It'll be across the board. If you think about a soldier going into a mosque and they're on patrol and he happens to shoot somebody in that mosque who's already been wounded, it goes from being a very tactical, localized event, because there is an embedded reporter there, to becoming an enormous strategic issue, political issue, that goes back to Washington, other capitals of the world, that feeds the insurgency, a whole variety of things. So the feedback loops in a very transparent information environment start to drive that shortening of tactical to strategic. The point is that information underneath there is going to tell us a lot that we don't know, because the head of the tail, we already know what's there, and it is usually self-reinforcing. It is often echo, as Jeff points out, in the head. There's going to be a lot of echo in the tail as well. So the point was to get to, do we want to encourage and participate in that area under the curve as a way of getting additional information that is richer in context, that may tell us a lot that we don't already know? And then if we do that, how does Jeff, in the technology that he's working to develop, how do we get to a point of filtering that in some way that makes it much more usable for us?
when in the example that I cited where I had one customer that had 100 million things show up every month, we worked on a data reduction strategy to do some echo canceling, and we got a 92% compression lossless. In the area of newspaper stories, there's some very practical techniques to determine when two articles are either exactly the same or really, really close, like only a paragraph or a sentence has been dropped. It is much harder to detect echo when you're getting, you know, hybrids and people are synthesizing two stories and writing their own and introducing no new content, but their sources are not even attributed to the two earlier sources. That would be, you know, the holy grail of echo canceling. Anyway.
Yeah, on the left here, name and affiliation, please.
I'm John Black. I'm with Groove Networks, which is part of Microsoft. And in my reserve affiliation, I deal with some of those covert and overt sources. And first to you. Found that the same briefing that was squelched through one channel was being briefed to the Secretary of Defense. So, in a time when power is shifting from traditional bases of power like the nation state to non-nation actors, I wonder if you can devise a way to use what's under the long tail and still get to your goals. You may find what's on the other side of this is you might eradicate the organization that you work with. You might eradicate its own power in doing so.
So we want those dissenting opinions that you have. We want you to be blogging about that. That's one of the key points here is if you can.
Chuck Cogan is next.
Chuck Cogan, Kennedy School. I like to think that what I'm about to say is limpid rather than simplistic. If you don't know what people's intentions are, read what they say, read their books. Don't reject them out of hand just because it isn't clandestine information. This is a lesson that we often have missed in our history from Adolf Hitler to Charles de Gaulle.
Thank you. Harlan?
Intellectually, how do you distinguish between and among learning, knowledge, intelligence, and information in this project?
Maybe you should restate that. Distinguish between learning, knowledge, and
information and intelligence. I mean, they're all different variables. They're based on facts. Different things. How much are you really focusing on teaching or learning and knowledge as opposed to intelligence and this and that?
Yeah, well, all the above, but I'd say a stronger emphasis on the former. These individuals we're bringing into this Trusted Information Network are their own. They represent networks, and they, in fact, filter all of this data that we're talking about through their own words, through their own writing, through their own choices of what they read and what they bring in. So they're bringing in the information. So the focus is on information being brought into this network and learning for everyone in the network and then producing analysis of this. Focused on, again, that specific subject of the roles, impact, and activities of Islamist extremists on Europe. So it's, I'd say, more the learning and the information side.
Time for two more. Yes, sir.
A quick question. By the way, I think this is terrific research. I've come away with two new ideas. So it seems to me also, in all this we're talking about tamping the echo, but on the other hand, the velocity and the height of the echo is also a measure of the volume in a way that tells you something. And Dubai Ports is a good case in point. I was very involved in that and following the blogs, following Google and everything else. And, boy, that just was like that. And at some point, it split. One part talking about facts and another part, you know, going off the deep end with Schumer and the rest of these guys. So is that not valuable, the height, the velocity, and all that?
Yeah, certainly it's important to see how many times a piece of data is ricocheting.
Yeah.
But to not recognize that it had one source, mm-hmm. you know, if you get some information, it says there's 10 people that said this is true, and it turns out only one person said it was true, that is really important intelligence. Mm-hmm. And we lose that in some of this in these echo problems.
But if 10 people believe it to be true, that's also important.
Yeah, yeah.
Any more questions?
Yep. Mark Huband, I'm formerly a journalist. Have you found that any of the sort of traditional rules of journalism are sort of weeding out some of these weaknesses with regard to echo? Clearly, journalism is a process as much as anything else. It's a process of evaluation of the validity of knowledge. Any story that you appear that appears in any newspaper has usually gone through the hands of several people who are able to perhaps evaluate to give it a value, but also to assess, you know, whether it's likely that it's something that has come from one direction, whether it really contradicts or whatever information that's coming from another direction. Is there any sort of particular view that you have of the way that journalism kind of gets around these problems?
Well, I mean, journalism implies a certain element of editorship, yeah. And what we're talking about here in this open source world is a difference between pre-filtering and post-filtering. And I would let me take it one sort of sideways step as well. Andy Marshall always told me, he said, if you want a new idea, read an old book. So I found this book thanks to an elevator conversation here in this building with Richard Danzig about a year ago. Went back to the 60s, called Unobtrusive Measures. And this is a wonderful sociological study that talks about surrogates for meaning. So if you want to have a sense of what the flows of jihadis are like, for example, returning jihadis to say, southern parts of France, you could do several things. You could go to your Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, Al Jazeera. You go to the head of the tail, and you can start looking for that somewhere. But you're only going to find what it is that they broadcast. Or you can start looking for these surrogate measures. And you can start looking for things in the tail, like the graffiti on the walls in the ghettos. Or you could look at the creation of youth hostels, really that are there to serve people who are coming through illegally, you know, not through customs, because these folks usually aren't going to be coming through customs. You can look for new little corner health clinics. You can look for penny rag newspapers that are being put up to welcome or to give news of what's going on at home, et cetera. There are a whole variety of things that you're not going to find in, unless somebody does a feature story, because they find it unusual and interesting too, and they write it. But you're probably not going to find that in the head of the tail. So then what you start doing is looking for people talking about these things, and that's where, you know, the filters and Jeff's talking about. You actually have little, you know, crawlers, and you start looking for scrubbers and crawlers and things. They're going to help you find interesting possibilities that are not part of what we call traditional journalism. Again, the difference between pre- and post-filtering.
Thank you, Dick. In closing, I think I should remind you that we're only 20 years away from what a prominent inventor now predicts is an inexorable process, the fusion of the human brain and machine, which takes us way beyond where we are today. Ray Kurzweil published last year the most blogged about book of 2005, which is a 640-page blockbuster titled The Singularity Is Near, a roadmap to a unique event with singular implications. The futuristic tome is the sequel to his last bestseller, The Age of Spiritual Machines, or When Computers Exceed Human Intelligence, which posited that ever-accelerating technological change would lead to computers rivaling the full range of human intelligence. Kurzweil now takes his readers to the next step, which he describes as the knowledge and skills embedded in our brains, will merge with the vastly greater capacity, speed, and knowledge-sharing ability of our own creations. So singularity will occur when technological change becomes so rapid and profound that our bodies and brains merge with our machines. I will not be around to see that because I already have my headstone written and it says I knew this would happen. But I do want to thank our two brilliant presenters, and please help me in giving them a very warm thank you. And now a couple of housekeeping announcements by our deputy director.
First thing I'd like to do is thank Jacqueline Harnden in the back, who's been the thread throughout all this and has put everything together and brought everyone together and managed an incredible group of people. So thank you, Jacqueline, for doing that. And I would just like to remind the core advisory group and members of the Trusted Information Network to proceed upstairs as soon as you can. Dr. Hamry will be making opening comments in a few minutes. So just try to be up there in 15 minutes at 11 o'clock. Thanks, everyone, for coming, and look forward to any comments you may have. Thank you very much.